The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, thanks for doing that. It makes it easier to talk when you can look directly at people. I'm Professor Hutchinson, and my colleague Pamela Bridgeward and I will be speaking to you about what I believe is one of the most important subjects in law school, that is critical race theory. I'm going to start talking first, and I'll give you a little bit of background about what critical race theory is, and then I want to talk about how you could use the skills of critical race theory to analyze a case that is of great interest to Latinos. So what is critical race theory? I'm glad to see so many people here interested in it. You are all first years, I assume, so some of... So there are second years here?
I think it was unfair to label it for one else as a critical race. Not everyone encounters critical race theory in school.
Well, you know what? I welcome anyone because I think it's a very important class. So I will tailor my comments to students generally. All right. The way I teach critical race theory is a seminar, and it's always booked to capacity with waiting lists, so students are very interested in it. And what I do on the first day is I try to give students a basic overview of what it is and to say, you know, things that they can expect for the semester. And the first thing I do is to just give a definition based on the title itself, critical race theory. So what is the critical part? Critical race theory criticizes the way in which the law treats questions of race, racial discrimination, racial subordination, which are two distinct concepts, and race relations. Okay, so it's a critical stance to the way in which the law, in particular the Supreme Court, deals with questions of race. The race part is pretty evident in the title to you, so I don't have to explain that. In theory, I think it's an important aspect of what critical race theory is. The purpose, or at least in its original format, the purpose of critical race theory was to offer new alternative ways of thinking about race. So there's always been this theoretical component to critical race theory. It was born in the academy, so naturally there is this theoretical component to it. Having said that, critical race theory is more than an academic movement. It's also a political movement that was born out of frustration with the way in which the law dealt with questions of race. And some of the things that critical race theorists have been particularly unhappy with is the way in which the court treats equal protection issues surrounding race, particularly the notion that it is unconstitutional to use race in public policy, even when the purpose of it is to remedy the effects of discrimination. Another important doctrine that critical race theorists, and I'm actually going to talk about this momentarily, have been upset with is the intent rule. I know a lot of you are first year, so you haven't had constitutional law yet, but under an equal protection analysis, in order to prove discrimination, you have to show that someone was out to get you, that they acted with intent, rather than showing that the effects of a policy discriminate against a particular race or gender or other protected class of individuals. One scholar has said that's a perpetrator perspective, that the law favors the perpetrator rather than looking at the impact of the policy on the victim. All right, so that's a basic overview of where critical race theory is coming from. With that, there are a lot of themes in critical race theory that are totally different from what you would get in any other law school class. Except Pamela Bridgewater's. And I remember when I first got to take critical race theory in law school, it was just such a relief to go into a class and talk about issues of race where the professor wasn't looking at me like I was some kind of freak from the X-Files, you know? But the themes that critical race theory are organized around include the belief that the law is not neutral, okay? The first thing they tell you that if you're in a litigation, you have an adversarial process looking for the neutral truth. Judges write opinions that utilize logic and reasoning to find the objective right outcome in a particular case. So law is built around this notion that we are looking for objective truth. Critical race theory says that the law is not neutral. The law is built around not only supporting but also creating racial inequality and other forms of inequality as well. Another important theme of critical race theory is that the doctrine of colorblindness, which I talked about earlier, where the court says that it's unconstitutional to think about race, is itself a tool of oppression, okay? Because what happens is that we freeze the status quo of racial inequality and make it impossible to design programs to remedy that inequality by actually identifying beneficiaries of those programs. Interestingly, even though there's this radical stance associated with critical race theory where they think the law is not neutral, that it facilitates and helps to construct racial oppression, there's at the same time this liberal notion to critical race theory that we can use the law to facilitate social change. And scholars in critical race theory have said that this is a duality, or it's a multiple consciousness. So there are different layers to critical race theory. One side thinks the law is just a bunch of BS, but the other side says, well, what else do we have to depend on? The law can bring about some positive social change. So if you ever take critical race theory, you're going to see the struggle around this particular tension, you know, being very critical about the law, but also wanting to use the law to bring about positive social change. Some of the other themes, and they'll become very relevant when I start talking about this case that I want to introduce you to, is that whereas the court seems to have a very myopic view about history, critical race theory believes that history, particularly history of racial domination, is central in deciding questions where race is salient. Okay, so critical race theory is centered around historical analysis of race. Critical race theory also believes that the victim's perspective is what is relevant. Rather than building law around what perpetrators believe they are doing or intend to do, the law should look at how policies impact persons of color and treat policies that harm those communities as unconstitutional, rather than only treating laws as unconstitutional if they are accompanied by an explicit statement or declaration that the lawmaker was out to get a particular community. So this centering of the victim in critical race theory is an important dimension of that analysis. One other important aspect of critical race theory, and it's one that I've written on a lot, is that critical race theory believes that you cannot treat race in isolation from other systems of oppression. And I was listening to part of the preceding discussion, and someone kept saying that we have to look at class as well. Well, critical race theory believes that we have to look at gender, class, sexual orientation, and we have to look at different ways in which race is experienced in the United States. So there's a rejection of discussing race purely in black and white terms, and instead there's a multicultural dimension to critical race theory. And in fact, there are a lot of movements that have evolved from critical race theory that are allied movements or parallel movements that utilize critical race theory but focus explicitly on bring in more multicultural component to race relations. For example, there's Latcrit theory, which is a very interesting development in critical race theory, and it's a very organized movement. There are conferences every year. Students can participate in them. They actually have scholarships for students to attend the workshops and present papers. I encourage you to get on the internet. All you have to do is type in Latcrit theory. You will find it. Professor Francisco Valdez at the University of Miami is one of the leading persons in the Latcrit theory movement, and if you're interested in following up on that, I encourage you to look up the information. I think there's a link to the Latcrit website on his homepage at the University of Miami. All right, so that's a general introduction to critical race theory. What I want to do in the remaining time that I have is to show you that this isn't just a bunch of theory, that there are practical implications of having a critical race analysis. And what I want to do is talk about a case that I hate. I really hate this case, so I'm putting it all out there first. It's called Hernandez versus New York. It's a 1991 decision by the Supreme Court. And in that case, the court held that a prosecutor's decision to use his peremptory challenges to exclude all Latino persons from a jury pool did not constitute unconstitutional discrimination. All right, so there are a lot of first years in here, so let me back up and give you some terminology. In criminal procedure, both sides, the prosecution and the defense, get a certain number of peremptory challenges, meaning they can exclude any juror just without giving a reason whatsoever. All right, there are also for cause challenges, which they get as well. Peremptory challenges, even though they generally do not require an explanation, if they follow a discriminatory pattern, such as race or gender, then the prosecutor or the defense attorney has to explain why they use those challenges in such a fashion. All right, and when you do that, it's called a Batson challenge, and it's named after a case that in which the Supreme Court held that it's unconstitutional to use peremptory challenges on a racially discriminatory fashion. I see a number of you shaking your heads. Have people read this case? Oh, man. Well, let's see how the analysis goes today versus what you did in your class. Which class was this? Civil procedure? Wow. Who taught that? Cool. All right. Okay, so there's a Batson challenge, and what happens is the side challenging the use of the peremptory challenges has to establish a prima facie case that race is being used. If the court is convinced of that, then it shifts to the opposing side to come up with a race-neutral reason for excluding those jurors. All right, in this case, the defendant clearly established his racial pattern because every Latino was excluded from the jury. All right, so it shifted to the prosecutor, and the prosecutor said two things. One, he said that after questioning the prospective Latino jurors, all of whom were bilingual, he said that he was not sure that they would accept the translation of the translator who was going to be translating the testimony at trial. And he thought that they might substitute their own translation for that of the official court translator and have undue influence on other members of the jury. Okay. The other thing he said, which was very interesting, is that he doesn't have any reason to disfavor or to favor Latino jurors because both the defendant and the victim in the case were Latino. So a prospective Latino or Latina juror could empathize with both sides. So there's no reason, he had no particular motivation to discriminate on the basis of Latino status. All right, so those are the facts. The Supreme Court affirmed the rulings below, which said that this was not racial discrimination, and Justice Kennedy wrote the decision. And there are several aspects of his ruling which critical race theory can be utilized to criticize. One, as he said, a mere disparate impact, though sometimes it can be material, was not so in this case. Instead, you have to show intentional discrimination. So the fact that all Latinos in the jury pool were excluded from this case was not enough. You still have to show that there was intentional racial discrimination. All right. Also said that the justification was legitimate. If a juror rejects the translation of the translator, then you have a problem because that's the official statement of the record. Third, the court said that discrimination against people who are bilingual isn't necessarily racial discrimination because there are non-Latinos who speak Spanish as well, okay? Even though this case took place in Brooklyn, New York, where most of the people who are speaking Spanish and English are Latino. All right, so the court's conclusion was that even though discrimination on the basis of language could potentially be a proxy for racial discrimination, it wasn't in this case. All right, what could critical race theory say about this? One, I think, is this is a blatant example of this perpetrator perspective where the court is looking for some angry person who's out to get persons of color, all right? Even though it looks like the prosecutor was doing that, you could argue that this is a more subtle case of racism. It's easy to mask racial purposes with neutral explanations, and the court in a variety of cases has failed to appreciate that possibility. The other thing I think that critical race theory could bring to bear in this analysis is history. There is a total lack of appreciation for the history of discrimination against Latinos and also the way in which language discrimination has been utilized to target particular communities. I mean, the whole English-only movement has received a lot of critique within critical race theory because of its impact upon persons of color. Another interesting aspect is that there's an entire history of discrimination against Black and Latino jurors that the court doesn't even mention in its decision, right? And there's a lot of social science which shows that, and prosecutors are very well aware of this, that persons of color are more sympathetic to defendants than when they are persons of color than whites are, all right? Study after study after study after study has shown this. And that's why historically prosecutors used to have explicit instructions to remove persons of color from juries. Now they do so under more neutral mechanisms. An interesting thing happened in New York after the O.J. Simpson verdict came out. And of course that was the first moment of where race mattered in a jury verdict in U.S. history. I say cynically. In New York, the New York Times had an article in which prosecutors across New York had meetings discussing how they could remove Black and Latinos from juries without using race explicitly. Okay, so they could focus on a number of things. Has a person in your family been a crime victim? Are you bilingual? Certainly would be something they could look at today. So speaking anonymously, of course, they said that this was a concern for them because they feared that people would, Latino and Black jurors would acquit more than white jurors. The other thing, and this is the last point I want to make about this case, is that the court seems to treat race as simply skin color in this case and doesn't appreciate the notion of what I call expressive identity, the notion that racial identity is much more than skin color. Some people say skin color isn't even race, but it's about a practice of culture and ideology and speech and fashion and a number of things that the court doesn't appreciate. And I would say that language is central to shaping racial identities, particularly for Latinos, and the court completely missed that in its analysis, did not appreciate that and simply reduced race to skin color and said they weren't trying to get Latinos as such, right, defined around skin color or biology. Instead, they were about language. But if you view language as a part of racial identity, then that dichotomy doesn't work. All right, so for those reasons, I hate the case. I hope that through this talk, you are more interested in critical race theory and you see that it's a tool that you can utilize in legal analysis and in law practice. I hope that some of you will take my class, but if you don't, make sure that you bring up these issues in other classes. Critical race theory is not something that you should just hide inside of critical race theory. It's something that you should utilize to discuss issues in all of your other classes. Thank you. I'm going to turn it over to my colleague.
Thank you, Professor Hutchinson. Professor Hutchinson is also a friend and a mentor to me with regard to shaping my thinking on critical race theory in particular, but a number of projects that I've worked on have benefited from his analysis and his participation in the evolution of critical race theory, so it's always a treat to work with him and present with him, and we're going to have drinks later. So that's always a treat, too. I want to first start out saying welcome to those of you who are not from D.C. and who are visiting and participating in this conference. I think it's a huge success, and I want to congratulate the students who helped to organize it and congratulate you for being here and participating. I'm Pamela Bridgewater. I'm a professor here at AU. I teach property law in the first year. I also teach inheritance law and reproduction and the law. I write about reproduction and race and gender issues, sexual expression. Brief descriptions of my scholarship, you can imagine how useful critical race theory has been for me in formulating the work that I do. I also, as Professor Hutchinson mentioned, sort of incorporate critical race theory in all of my classes. It is not something that I teach a sort of separate course in, because we have experts in the area to do that, but based on and building from the work of those experts and theorists in those in critical race theory, those of us who recognize the mode of analysis of critical race theory as an excellent way of understanding how the law works, And with regard to power and a redistribution of rights and wealth, understand it and use it in that way, and it's been quite effective in showing students an alternative, and many argue, as do I, an enhanced and better view of law and legal education. One of the things I want to talk to you about is that law student experience and how critical race theory and its evolution came from the law student's experience in the era prior to critical race theory as a sort of formal or institutionalized area. But it was students much like yourselves who came to law school and engaged in the study of law and didn't hear about themselves, right, and didn't see themselves in the presentation of cases, but having a deep, abiding feeling and belief that, you know, these laws affect, in these cases, we're here, we're just not being talked about, or, you know, and how these cases affect their lives and the lives of people in their community. But when they went to their administrations at their various schools to ask for professors who looked like them or who would present law cases and legal theory in a way that included them, they were met with at best no response, and at sometimes hostility. And it led to a great deal of student activism around wanting a different mode of analysis, a different experience within the law schools. I mean, it was during a time, I think Darren and I represent sort of a second generation removed from that moment. We're sort of inherited that activism, the work of those students, and professors, but it was a very active time that all this went through. I mean, there were resignations of professors from schools and sit-ins and all sorts of things done by students of color, students who experienced themselves as invisible in the mode of analysis that traditionally took place in law school. And so from that experience came a body of work for those institutions that were responsive to the organizing of the students and the demands of the students, hiring professors of color, hiring theorists, critical race theorists, hiring people who were able to look at the law and understand not only how it affected people of color, but be able to relate that in class, gave rise to a second generation of people who were interested, who now had the benefit of seeing themselves in law school classes and could build upon those theories. And that's basically what happened, is that from that organizing of students in response to the lack of focus on issues of race, subordination, and identity, law students who had a chance to benefit from inclusion built upon theories in critical race theories. And what is always the case, and in fact is a good thing, turned their critique or built a critique of the first generation of critical race theorists. So they built upon it. So whereas critical race theory was seen initially as a largely a field largely dominated by men and from a male perspective, from subject to the black-white paradigm, the second generation of critical race theorists said, wait a second, we are very diverse within our communities. There are Latinos, there are immigrant issues, there are language issues, there are sexual orientation issues, there are gender issues that create this multidimensional, to use a hallmark phrase from Darren's work, that we need to focus on. And from that second wave came sort of what is known as critical race feminism. That is the voice that most formally set itself out as a evolution or a growth from the original crit race. And so in that body of work, critical race feminism, there's a lot of diversity that is captured by that critique. There's sexual orientation. There are women who write about reproduction. I'm one of them. Theorists who write about immigrant issues and labor issues, language issues. And I would urge, I brought a copy of my copy that I keep close, of an anthology of critical race feminism that I urge you in your spare time that all first years have an abundance of, that you should check this out at your library or even buy a copy. And as you'll notice from just thumbing through it, and you're welcome to after this or when you get yours, there are a number of Latina and Latino critical race theorists represented in here and that offer an invaluable contribution to the field. One of the things in terms of how that theory, I think it might be described as a third generation or just another important part of the second generation, as is the impact of critical race feminism or lat crit on how we approach law, the making of laws that are made or laws that are come from case law. And one of those things is how we think about multidimensionality as a litigation strategy. The sort of first wave of critical race sort of focused on or is known for its intersectionality critique, and that it was sort of this one vector of race and the, another vector representing gender, and that courts were ill-equipped and laws were ill-equipped to meet women in particular at that intersection, right? And that's where women of color existed at that intersection. And the critique was laws don't help. Laws that are meant to protect gender, laws that are meant to protect race, and that you have to choose your theory. So a woman of color who comes before the court and says, as I was discriminated against not only because of who I am as a woman, but who I am as a woman of color, and there's a specific experience that I don't share with a white woman or that I don't share with a man of color, the law said we have no redress for you. And so intersectionality built upon that. But at this phase in critical race theory, we're seeing, as Darren mentioned, that there are all sorts of ways in which our identities create what we experience discrimination based on our identities because we are multidimensional. We have, like I said, language, sexuality. We have class privilege issues, and so we are now sort of at a phase where we're trying to critique the law's responsiveness to our diversity within communities of color. One of the things that my work focuses on in that regard is adding conduct or experience to identity. For example, one of the things I argue is that not only are issues of gender and sexuality and race a part of a lot of experiences of women of color, but also our expression of our reproductive capacities, how we engage in reproductive decision making, for example, is very much colored by, no pun intended, by who we are racially and who we are in relationship to our communities and who we choose to partner with. But one of the things that I focus on most specifically is who we are, our identities inform how we feel vulnerable to exploitation around reproduction. For example, reproductive manipulation is something that's widespread, but the experience Latinas have to reproductive manipulation might grow from the history of sterilizing Puerto Rican women, right? Or the experience of vulnerability that indigenous women have grows from their vulnerability to forced use of formula with their babies, and scores of babies died. It encourages them not to breastfeed, or using different chemicals to decrease their sexual drive in an effort to decrease their numbers, or for African American women who have a history of being bred, descendants of slaves who were bred, who had their reproductive capacities exploited to make more slaves. And so our vulnerabilities, our identities grow from the particular experience. So I'm sort of now working on a project that looks at the ways in which our diverse histories create a part of our identities. And it's sort of, and I'll just mention this one project as an example before we open it up to questions about anything, about our work, about your first year experience, about anything, because we do want to have this be a forum. But one particular project that I'm working on where this theory that I'm developing plays out is in thinking about reproductive decision making as economic decision making, and trying to fashion an economic theory that captures reproduction. For example, when we negotiate, we as the United States negotiates free trade agreements, reproduction has never been on the table as a factor to consider. even though organizers and activists in the areas of reproduction know that women, for example, in Mexico who immigrate to the United States to be child care providers support the reproductive decision maker, the reproductive decisions of women in the North, that but for the ability of women, or but for the existence of women who are available to take care of their children, they wouldn't be able to have a free sort of expression of their reproductive capacities. And that creates an economic reality that has an economic impact on trade, right? Because opening up borders means workers are able to flow more freely. And so by defining women who come to care for children in the North as laborers and having issues to be discussed at the table of free trade agreement might add more protection to those women, that they're able to access more protection when they get here. But for now, it's off the table, and it's still sort of a subverted market that is outside of the reach of legal protection. So that's one example that I use in a project of trying to sort of develop existing theories to fit the experience and conduct and decisions that women make. So it's in the early stages, but I hope that you'll, you know, once it's done, that you'll check it out. But I do at this point want to open up the floor to questions or comments or venting or whatever.
Does Labyrinth theory differ in any way substantially to mainline critical race theory, or is it really just the focus on the
There is a debate that may not be a debate that is played out in writing as to whether there is a difference between Latin and critical race theory.
You don't air our dirty laundry, but right. we fuss about this often.
I'll put it this way. And I guess to appreciate the Latin movement and its relationship to critical race, you have to understand some of the earlier history of critical race. Even though critical race has always had sort of a multiracial component to it, some of the earliest people are Mari Matsuda, Richard Delgado, Kimberly Crenshaw, Derek Bell. I would say that an honest assessment of that scholarship, and this follows patterns beyond critical race theory, is that race was discussed even by some of those scholars who were not black in black-white terms. And at some point, and this is right around the time we entered into the academy, there are all these internal wars that happen around questions of the black-white paradigm, sexuality, gender, and class. And I guess, like in controversy, I got right in the thick of it. Lat-Crit theory started as a movement, I guess really the architects were Francisco Valdez and Elizabeth Iglesias at the University of Miami. They created this organization that they believed was more receptive to diverse communities. They employed the same methodology of critical race theory. So to answer the question briefly, you see the same types of arguments. And so on some level, they're indistinct. I think the primary differences are that what is identified as Lat-Crit theory tends to have a focus on Latinos, but it's not exclusively. And there's the institutional component to it, where there are actual conferences, organizations, workshops for students, all of that. That separates Lat-Crit from critical race theory. But once you get into it, the substance of what's being talked about tends to be the same, except for the emphasis on Latinos.
Yeah, and I agree with all that Darren said. I just would add that both Darren and I are members of Lat-Crit. We go to conferences, we present, and we are members of that community and in solidarity, and it's just commonality of thoughts and ideas. What the debates that we've engaged in around the creation of Lat-Crit is much like when the shift came from critical race theory to critical race feminism. The name changed, but not in a way that was smaller, right? It was more broad. And so one of the debates that I've engaged in is when it shift to lack crit, that I experienced that as a more narrowing, though it's not reflected in the writing, right? Lack crit actually broadened the scope and included sexual orientation, included all of these things, but the name, I mean, when you just hear it out and use it, it sounds as if its primary focus is on issues almost exclusively Latino, and while I don't have a problem with that, it wasn't the intent of the founders. Francisco, they wanted a more broad thing, and that's an ongoing debate, but it has not stopped the work that goes into making it an inclusive body of work. Yeah.
I'll start with the first part of your question where you said there won't be a particular majority. I think we have to be careful in how the mass media has been portraying this as sort of the end of race as we know it. In the late 90s, these articles started appearing every day saying one of two things. First, that several states, California and Texas in particular, were going to become majority non-white. Okay, that was the first side of it. And it's like, were they afraid that this was going to happen, so they started writing the articles a decade earlier? Or is this just some sociology that's going on? And the other thing that's happened recently are a number of articles saying how Latinos are now the largest minority population in the United States. All right, I never take things at face value, so there's always some type of nefarious plot going on. All right, I'm Fox Mulder. With this type of analysis, the first thing to remember is that power is not simply demographic. Right? If you ever feel yourselves thinking that numbers is all that it matters, think South Africa, and then the whole debate ends. Power is certainly related to numbers, but it's not simply a function of demographics. It's history, it's economics, it's sexuality, it's a number of things. So I think that even as these demographic shifts occur, we're going to have the same issues. All right, we're going to have to deal with poverty, we're going to have to deal with brutality, violence, etc. I think, though, that as numbers of persons of color develop at higher rates than whites, there becomes an opportunity for more coalition politics. And I'm a big fan of coalition politics. I think that we need more of them. The interesting thing is how communities of color do not like to engage in coalition politics. And it's remarkable the extent to which there are issues that unify us but which we don't organize around. And that's been a big aspect of my scholarship, trying to show people that there are these connections and that the only way that we can really have a larger voice is if we organize around them, but getting people to do that involves getting them to acknowledge that they actually harbor some discrimination themselves. Right? I think that a lot of people they like to frame it as, oh, well, if we work on this issue, then we won't be focused on our cause anymore. And it sounds like the race-neutral thing in the Hernandez case. We weren't discriminating against them because they were Latino, but they spoke Spanish and English. But what happens is people, they don't want to organize with feminists because they got some sexism going on. They don't want to organize with gays and lesbians because they're homophobic. So I think that is probably one of the biggest issues that we need to focus on, and these demographic shifts give us the opportunity to think more powerfully about that.
Yeah, I would agree. Also, I think, I mean, if I were the target audience to those reports, right, that white folks are becoming minorities and Latinos, our numbers are increasing, right, if that was meant for me, I would think as a white person, right, then perhaps we should start shifting the definition of whiteness to include, right, some of these, you know, increasing numbers of Latinos, and that is, I think, another aspect of this sort of this deluge of media reports. But as I know, and I'm sure you know, that there's a lot of diversity within the Latino community that's not reflected in those numbers, as Darren pointed out. Demographics, the numbers are just one part, but there's power, and there is in ways similar to the Black community, a lot of intra community or intra identity group issues, right, with regard to priorities, power dynamics, or whatever. But that's never reflected in the numbers. As if the entire Latino population is not monolithic, right? And it's just not so. So with that in mind, I'm not quite sure, as a person who's not the target of those media reports, I start to think, as Dan mentioned, about coalition building and the opportunity for it. But as long as I think we are still internalizing the notion of scarcity of resources, the coalition building opportunities will be challenged, I think. We will find that we will experience obstacles in building coalitions if as members of marginalized groups, we feel like there's only so much to go around, which majoritarian messages have a stake in making us think that, but it's not necessarily the case.
What can we as students of color, especially as law students of color, do to challenge our peers and sometimes our professors who are either not people of color or sometimes they are people of color who are unwilling to think in that critical race theory paradigm? I mean, what can we do to challenge them to think outside of that box?
I think in large part it depends on your institution. For example, American is a special place because, in a lot of ways, but with regard to race issues, there are a number of professors of color on the faculty here, and there are a number of professors of color who engage in race and critical race theory and are approachable around those issues. And so your professors and who your professors are, and if you can talk to them first, makes a big difference. But if you're in an institution where there are no professors of color, or the ones that are there are hostile or not approachable to help in strategizing a response, then your range of options will be very different than a place like American. and responses, and the vast majority of law schools are not like American. So the vast majority of students who are struggling with this issue have to come up with ideas on their own and not with professors. And responses have ranged from, I remember hearing about a colleague just, you know, had enough of the professors making her invisible or outright hostility, and she went to see the professor and spoke her mind to him. And there have been other people who share their experiences about strategies in class, talking to the professor, confronting their students, their peers in class. I think in terms of real suggestions of things to do, I think being a part of an organization like this is really important, because while you may not be at American, you're now connected to people here and vice versa. And so email is great because you can ask for suggestions for folks at other institutions. But also you can contact and you can have access to other professors at other institutions, right? So getting this book, for example, or connecting to LACCRIT or getting our information from our website would be a good strategy, because while we may not be at your institution and know the institutional culture there, it's likely that we have either experienced it ourselves or know people to put you in touch with. So communication, reaching out, asking for suggestions.
Okay. I'll let them talk.
Yeah, okay.
I was wondering if you could maybe suggest two books and two articles that you recommend that people read kind of as an introduction to
this. I have two. And actually, it's the two that I teach in my class. Richard Delgado has an anthology. It's called Critical Race Theory, The Cutting Edge. And then there's another one called Critical Race Theory, The Key Writings That Formed the Movement. And that's edited by Kimberly Crenshaw and a few other people. These reflect some of the older generation critical race theory stuff, but they can lead you to other articles. There is a newer book that is edited by Francisco Valdez. This is the third time I've mentioned Frank's name. I can't remember the name of the title now, though. So there are several critical race anthologies out there. If you just punch in critical race theory on Amazon, it'll actually pull up a lot of them. But the two that I mentioned are the leading ones. In terms of particular articles, I can combine this answer with the previous question. Whether you're first year, second, or third year, sometimes if you don't have critical race at your school, you have to arm yourselves. And I think most professors, I'm pretty safe in saying this, they welcome students bringing up ideas in class. I think a lot of people are nervous to bring up controversial ideas, but one way of feeling more comfortable about that is to actually go and read articles on the subject. The anthologies cut them down to like bare bones form, so it's easier for you to comprehend. But you can spend time on Westlaw if you know there's a particular issue coming up in one of your classes and you don't want to sit there not having your perspective raised. Why don't you do a little bit of background reading on it? And I assure you professors will say, wow, that person actually took the initiative to do some outside reading. You could even say, I was reading in the Harvard Law Review last week that Hernandez marginalized Latinos. And the professor will say, oh, tell me more about that. So those are ways in which you could learn a lot more, but also bring up issues in the classroom that the professor may not be sensitive to.
My suggestions, I've already suggested one, the Critical Race Feminism Anthology. I would also suggest Patricia Williams' Diary of a Law Professor.
Mad Law Professor.
Is it Mad? No, that's a nation.
She's mad.
Okay. So, Diary of a Law Professor by Patricia Williams. And I, you know, especially for first years, but I think second and third years would enjoy this and find utility in it as well. She talks about the her experience as a black woman in relation to the law. She talks about her students' experience of you know, reading an exam where all in crim law, where all the criminals are people of color and all the victims are white, and so she flushes through that analysis. She teaches contracts and talks about her experience with contracts. So that's one that I would definitely get, and it's a good it's prose that is good to you know, accessible. In terms of articles, I would suggest anything that Darren's written, because and the reason why I say that honestly is because as a critical race theorist, he took the body of work, the canon in critical race theory, and exploded it to this sort of multidimensionality critique, which included class, which included sexual orientation, which included a more broad way of constructing identity and experiencing the law. So so his early articles up into ones that he's written most recently. The second article is was Blonde But Now I See article whiteness as property. Cal Rose.
No.
Am I mixing two?
You're mixing two articles. It was Blind But Now I See, and it's a critique of the discriminatory intent rule. The only problem is I can't remember who wrote it right now. It's in the Michigan Law Review.
Cheryl Rose article is...
Are you talking about whiteness as property?
Right,
Cheryl
right.
Harris.
Cheryl Harris. Whiteness is...
Property.
I
want to jump in here a little bit. Every year, the Lat Crit proceedings are published in some law review across the country. And if you find the Lat Crit website, it'll tell you the history of where they've been published. So that's a good way of sort of getting an introduction. Also, there are specialty Latino law reviews. Harvard has the Harvard Latino Law Journal. There's the Chicano Latino Law Journal, UCLA. Michigan has a Journal of Race and Law, so those are other resources that you can use. Berkeley has
La Raza.
Okay. So there are several specialized journals that publish Latino issues, particularly that you should, and students publish in them. And if, actually, if you're interested, you should try to submit because a lot of them are open to student publications. I see people assembling for the next panel, but we do have a little bit more time because I was told that we get a full hour regardless of what time.
Let's have one more comment.
One or two.
One or two, Dan. Yeah.
I worked at NARAL, Teachers America, in the Legal and Law Services Department. As a woman of color working there, it was very hard for me and very exhausting to try to explain that women of color have different experiences with regards to reproductive rights historically and presently. And the work that you're doing is amazing to me because, you know, I spent 2 years there struggling. You know, I was just this girl that, you know, graduated from college and came in supposedly knowing more than everyone else, but, you know, no one wanted to listen, where I knew I could speak from experience, I could speak from the classes that I took from college, and it's great to see that, you know, people like you do exist.
Yeah.
I don't know why NARAL and all these other organizations can't look to you for more guidance as far as, you know, academic research and, you know, the legislation that's out there. You have to analyze it and see how is it going to affect women of color, how is it going to affect lesbians, how, you know, and so I think what you're doing is great, and I hope that
Right on. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think you're right on, and I think everyone in the room can identify with their own to that comment. And which leads me to another suggestion, building on Darren's suggestion of arming yourselves. I carried around in law school a copy of Audre Lorde's Sister Outsider. And in particular, she has an article, an essay, where she talks about transforming silence into language and action. And in that essay, she talks about the risk we take with speaking out, and that we have to go through this sort of formula in whether or not to do it, but it's almost always better to speak out. But what that does is create an extra burden. I mean, I'm sure you find yourself asking, you know, why do I have to be the race person in the room? Why do I have to teach? I just want to read my cases for class and not have to worry about teaching everybody else how to do what they do, right? Right, and you don't want that obligation. So we have to do that formula. But Audre Lorde says that we should almost always speak out, and even if, and this is going to be, this is open to critique. But with many of us being the first person in our families and our communities to, you know, have access to NARAL or have access to lawyers. You know, for every one of us sitting here, there are hundreds of people we know who are as smart as us, who won't achieve and won't have the power that, and privilege that we have of this education. So I'm not telling you what to do with that information, but that is a reality, and that's the reality of people of color in legal, in our profession. But when you face that reality, just put that in the formula when you're deciding whether or not to speak, because it's an important thing. You may still decide, you know, that I just cannot bear, I can't wave this flag right now. I'm just too tired, and no one would fault you. But understand the thousands of voices that will not be heard with our decisions not to speak.
Anyone else? All right, thanks for
coming. Thank you so much.